Live from the great American Northwest, it's Pro-Libertate Radio, a full-throttle, no-holds-barred examination of the threats to life, liberty, and property. Now, here's our host, author, lecturer, and investigative journalist, William Norman Gregg. Trump, what
you doing? One of the writers I really enjoy is a fellow by the name of La Rochefoucauld. I'm sure I'm butchering the name. I don't speak French, although I read a little bit of it. And he wrote a book. Actually, his pithy and epigrammatic sayings were condensed into this book called Maxims. And I'm going to paraphrase one of them from memory, so I'll probably get it somewhat wrong, but substantively, I think I'll get it correct. He warned that as we get older, we seem to remember everything in great detail, except for the number of times we've tortured our friends with the same old stories. So if I lapse into that habit, first of all, you should take that as evidence that I'm not immune to the destructive march of time, no more immune than anybody else. And secondly, that I've got a lot on my mind and sometimes I misplace things. But at the risk of succumbing to that problem, I'd like to share with you again something that I consider one of my maxims of life. And this is something that I embraced by way of a guide for understanding reality maybe about a year and a half or 2 years ago. God gave us the gifts of faith, freedom, and fellowship. Those are gifts that he gave to man. And from those gifts, men have forged the fetters of religion. There's, I think, a substantive difference between faith, the faith of a believer, and religion. Now, religion can be a good thing. It comes, I believe, from a Latin expression, religare. I mean, I think that means to bind together, to connect, to bind together. And of course, if you read the New Testament, Christian believers are admonished to have their hearts knit together in love. We're supposed to seek out and not eschew the assembly of the faithful, that sort of thing. There are a lot of wonderful blessings that descend from one's association with like-minded people in the faith. Unfortunately, and Butler Schaefer, who writes at lewrockwell.com, I think has probably isolated the key truth of the matter here. Every institution of human manufacture, which is to say every institution in which humans are involved in positions of authority, whether genuine or usurped over others, eventually becomes an exercise in self-preservation at the expense of principle. And of course, that's certainly the case, unfortunately, with religion. I'm not going to say organized religion, because really there is no other kind. If bound together, there's organization involved. If you're not bound together, then religion, religare, is not occurring. Now, of course, the Epistle of James talks about pure religion and undefiled being the outworking of one's faith in the form of charity toward others. And I think that that is, obviously, because that meets the biblical standard, the best and most suitable form of worship and religion as applied in human experience. Now, I'm giving this by way of a somewhat lengthy and discursive preface to the following stories that I think are just wonderful. Held up at gunpoint, a store clerk invoked her faith to turn the desperate thief into a repentant gunman. This is from ABC News yesterday. When a man tried to rob a Metro PCS cell phone store at gunpoint in Pompano Beach, Florida, store manager Nayara Gonclaves, 20, calmly talked to the man about Jesus and her faith until he left without taking any money. I believe it was the Holy Spirit of God that really made me want to tell him about Jesus, Gonclaves told ABCNews.com. I would never be able to do that myself. I would never think that God could use me the way he did, she said. God impressed me. A store surveillance camera captured the whole exchange between Gonclaves and the would-be robber, and I've seen that video. Many of you may have seen it as well, and it's really quite remarkable. The man entered the store and made small talk about the rainy weather. He asked to see a phone and then showed Gonclaves a gun and nervously asked for the money in the register. I really hate to do this, the gunman told Gonclaves. I'm pronouncing that name incorrectly. It should be Gonclaves or Goncalves. I'm going to say Gonclaves. She slowly walked towards the register and started to speak to the man, who told her not to be afraid. I'm not, she said. I'm just going to talk to you about the Jesus I have. May God bless you for that, the robber said in return. Just know in mind that I absolutely hate doing this. I'm embarrassed I have to do this and that I have no choice. Goncalves continued to talk to the man about God, and it started to work. Already nervous and reluctant, the man slumped onto the counter and looked more and more defeated. Now, I'm loving this story. Jesus got something way better for you, Goncalves told him. I don't know what you were going through, but all of us are going through a hard time right now. The man admitted that he is a Christian, albeit obviously a lapsed one, and told Goncalves that he goes to church at Calvary Chapel. She had been there too. As it turned out, they both knew one of the ministers, Pastor Bob. The man apologized over and over to Goncalves, who stayed positive and calm throughout the ordeal. She even offered to help him find a job. The man said he already had one. Then what are you doing here? She asked. Because I'm going to be evicted if I don't come up with $300, the robber said. Though the man clearly felt guilty about robbing the store, he hadn't given up on his original goal. When Goncalves showed him the money in the register, he told her he had to take all of it. Once she told him that it would come out of her paycheck, however, he backed down. I don't want to do that to you. I'm sorry, he said. Before the man left, Goncalves pleaded with him to think about what he had done to get back in touch with his faith. Jesus helps you. He can change your life. Go back to church. Find a job. Get real friends in church. Talk to a pastor. They can pray for you. You don't need to do this. Jesus is coming soon, she told him. Boy, I hope that's true. I'm getting impatient myself. Completely defeated, the man revealed that his weapon was only a BB gun. He then complimented Goncalves. You know one thing, the robber said? Good will be coming your way for what you did today. You have a good day and God bless you, he said as he left. Goncalves said she started to cry after he exited the store because she was relieved and awed at what had just taken place. I do consider this to be awesome myself. I realized what had just happened, what could happen, what could have happened if God wasn't here with me, she said. What Goncalves said appeared to have greatly affected the man. I believe I touched him with what I said, Goncalves told ABC News. I really hope I planted a little seed in his heart. The Broward County Sheriff's Office is searching for the man who has been described as a white male who stands 5'9", in his 30s or 40s, and has a mustache. They say the long surveillance video and the clues he gave during it about where he went to church should help them track down the man. Kyla Concepcion, spokesperson for the Sheriff's Office, said they were all surprised by the incident. It's completely unique, to say the least, she told ABCNews.com. Usually we would tell people that you just comply with whatever the demands of the robber are, Concepcion said. This definitely turned out to work well for her. Well, it was awesome, but it was not unique. A couple of years ago, it turns out there was a very similar incident in Indianapolis. Hours after an Indianapolis store clerk said divine intervention helped her convince a would-be thief to give up mid-heist, the alleged robber agreed that God played a major role in his dramatic change of heart. It had to be God working through her because she just talked to me like a mother or a grandmother to her child, and she made me feel comfortable, robbery suspect Gregory Smith, 23, said in an emotional jailhouse interview with AB News' Indianapolis affiliate WRTV Thursday. This is from October 2009. I started telling her stuff I hadn't even told my own mother. I even tried to give her the gun, but she wouldn't take it. To everybody who I've affected with this, I just want to say I'm sorry for putting you all through this, he said. Store clerk Angela Montez said Thursday it was divine intervention that led Smith to give up his heist and talk and pray with her for nearly 40 minutes Monday, before turning himself in to Indianapolis police hours later. I believe the Lord sent us both together, Montez told Good Morning America Thursday. The more we talked, he just broke down. He said, talk to me. No one will talk to me. I have nobody. Surveillance cameras recorded video of an armed man alleged to be Smith of Indianapolis jumping over the counter at a check cashing store where Montez worked and pointing a gun at her Monday. Montez, fearing for her life, broke down crying and praying. I can't even explain the feeling of a gun, she said. I remember looking at the silver gun, and the finger was on the trigger. I thought, this is it. But after seeing how much he was scaring her, Montez said Smith apologized and tried to explain himself. I told him, don't do this. You're young. Don't do this to jeopardize your life. He started crying. But we're going to be homeless. I haven't had a job in months. I've tried everything. Smith told Montez, 43, he was an ex-serviceman and had a young baby. He said he didn't know where his mother was at the time, and where the mother was at the time, presumably the mother of the baby, and his mother, and he had never known his father. At one point, Smith reached for the gun again. which scared Montez into praying for her own forgiveness before what she thought was her death. But Smith took out the only bullet in the gun and gave it to her, Montez said. Just take it and talk to me, Smith said, according to Montez. The unlikely pair talked for nearly 40 minutes without being interrupted by anyone else entering the store or any phone calls, a sign, Montez said, that God wanted them to talk. I felt a warmness, even though there was a scare, she said. There were so many places around us. No one came to the door. No one called. I can't believe it was that long when I was told how long we had talked. It's a wonderful experience, and I believe, as somebody who's a convinced Christian, that this is God working in the hearts of people. This is Will Grigg, Pro Libertate Radio, 866-986-6397, and we'll be back in just a minute. System memory crash.
Now, back to our host, author, lecturer, and investigative journalist, William Norman Grigg.
1-866-986-6397 is our call-in number here on the Liberty News Radio Network. I am Will Grigg. This is Pro Libertate Radio. And for those of you who think that somehow my captious spirit has been pacified and tranquilized, fret not. There is going to be a lot of caustic and invective-laden commentary forthcoming. It's just that so infrequently do I have the opportunity to talk about something I find edifying and inspiring. I want to seize those rare occasions when they present themselves to me. And here we had these two stories of acts of violence that were diffused by an appeal to those elements of our personality that reflect the impress of our maker, I firmly and resolutely believe. As somebody who is a Christian believer, however critical I am of denominational or sectarian or denominational flavored political organizations and ambitions and agendas, I remain a believer, a firm and resolute believer in the elative sense. I believe that's what Cardinal Newman referred to, that quality within us that gravitates toward that which is good, true, just, and beautiful. And I believe that that's something which reflects a design. And I believe that that designer was given the form of the man known as Jesus of Nazareth. That's my short catechism, if you will, my short statement of faith. Very quickly, we do have a caller on the line who has been exemplary in his patience, as most of you are. I wanted to share one more story of this same type. And this one is even more unusual because I'm about to say something by way of commendation for not only a police officer, but a SWAT officer from Los Angeles. Randall Simmons died at the age of 51 a couple of years ago. He was the first casualty, I believe, in the history of Los Angeles SWAT, which is the oldest SWAT team. I believe they were formed in 1968. The first casualty to occur in the line of duty. And of course, it would take a man like this. He was a magnificent human being. He was somebody who was old school in the best sense of that expression. He was called the deacon because in his off-duty hours, he was a preacher, but he also ministered in practical terms to the children of his neighborhood. He looked like somebody you'd find from Central Casting to play the role of the muscular, charismatic police officer. He looked a little like, oh, for heaven's sake, what is the name of the fellow who used to be on NYPD? Not NYPD Blue. There was a show back in the 1970s called NYPD. He played the commandant of Starfleet in Star Trek III, a very photogenic black fellow with a mustache. Well, that's what Randall Simmons looked like. Actually, he looked like Andre Dawson, the baseball player who spent a career playing for cellar dwellers, the Montreal Expos, and then the Chicago Cubs. He actually won the Most Valuable Player Award in, if memory serves, 1987, when Chicago finished dead last in the division, which is where Chicago tends to finish. But this is a fellow who was not only a police officer, he was somebody who approached this as a ministry. And he died at age 51, which means that he was still very much in the thick of things on the wrong side of what most people would consider to be middle age. I think 50 is the new 30, as I close in on it sort of warily. This is from a Los Angeles Daily News obituary. Simmons was shot in the line of duty on his, he was shot in the line of duty the first year on the job, and he survived that shooting. One day, he found himself chasing a suspect down the street. The man had a gun, and the man suddenly stopped and pointed the gun at him, meaning Simmons. He felt fear because he thought, I'm going to die. But then Simmons summoned his faith and shouted to the man, do you know Jesus? And the man broke down, Adams said. Adams is the sister of Simmons speaking at his funeral. The man broke down, and he witnessed to the guy. Now, think of that for a second. They're in a foot chase and a potential gun battle. The first thing that comes to this officer's mind is to ask the man in terms that a Christian believer would recognize as a profession of faith. And it worked. Chances are we're going to be seeing a lot of ugliness as the economy continues to worsen, as our predicament as a culture continues to ripen. People will be driven to do desperate and stupid things. I'm just hoping that as the desperation quotient increases, that we'll be given the grace, and I firmly believe, once again, I know the origin of that grace. Wherever it comes from and however it's recognized, I hope that all of us and each of us find it, because we're going to be tested in ways that we can only barely begin to imagine now. With that lengthy preface, I turn to the long-suffering Art from Arizona, who has displayed magnificent and commendable patience waiting for me to turn to him. Art, are you there this evening?
Yes, Will. Good to talk to you.
Good to talk to you. How may I be of service?
By now, I'm sure you've heard of what the U.S. District Court judge did in her ruling against Arizona's anti-illegal immigration law. My question to you is, you know, we tried to fix this in 1986, I believe. What, 24 years ago was the last time the U.S. government tried to put a big fix on the illegal immigration question, and that was supposed to fix the problem from henceforward. Obviously, it did not. My question to you is, how would you fix this problem? We don't have enough jobs here for Americans, much less for illegals. What are we going to do? Our country is doomed if we don't do something about this.
I think our country is doomed unless we do something about the government destroying our jobs. And I think that the finitude of our employment opportunities reflects government intervention in the economy more than a question of government's neglect with respect to immigration policy. Just a couple of quick words.
I agree with you on that point.
Yeah,
but again,
couple
my
of
question is, how do we fix the illegal immigration problem?
The first thing we have to do, I think, is to shut off the magnet. And the magnet, of course, would be welfare benefits. Whatever else we do, if we don't do that, nothing else is going to work. Another thing we
jobs,
need to do,
but not any,
what's
not that? That anymore. It used to be the magnet of them being able to get make a decent wage here, but they can't even do that anymore.
Well, that's one reason immigration's actually tapered off over the last 5 or 6 years. They're not coming here because they can't find work.
They're still
and
coming
remittances,
in droves, Will.
Well, the droves are smaller. I mean, they were coming in legions, now they're coming in phalanxes, perhaps.
Speaking of legions,
I mean, take the good news where you can find it. Well, the thing, that's a good point. I mean, there are a couple of people like Max Boot who want to duplicate in precise detail what the Romans did to destroy themselves, up to and including offering citizenship to all and sundry who'd serve in the legions. But you turn off the magnet, that's one thing. Then you shut down the engine that is driving them out of Mexico, which means that you stop subsidizing the Civil War. The federal government in this country has been subsidizing the so-called war on drugs, which is an actual shooting war, civil war in Mexico, which is helping to drive people northward. And this is something that not many people are talking about, but that plays a real role, particularly when you're talking about Nogales and the situation with Laredo, Nuevo Laredo.
I think also the problem, and often I've heard people say this, what we need to do is give those people a weapon and send them back to Mexico so they can have a good old-fashioned revolution, because that's part of the problem of why things are the way they are in Mexico.
You know what, if we weren't propping up that government, I think it would collapse under the weight of its own accumulated corruption. And I think that would be a good thing. for the people of Mexico, because they've been living under one of the most ossified dictatorial juntas in the history of mankind. They had their Marxist revolution 7 years before the one in Russia, and it sort of took on a hybrid character, because it's not pure Marxism that you have in Mexico. It's crony capitalism, a type of feudal economy. But yeah, that's the sort of thing that I think would be healthy, is if we'd stop propping up that regime and stop running the welfare magnet that's attracting people over the border, and then backing up people who are exercising the right to self-defense and defense of the property against trespassing. Think of it in those terms, and I think that that would help solve the problem. And maybe on the other side of the break, I'll have some other suggestions. You want to hang with us for the break, Art?
Sure, I'll hold on.
Okay, Art will be with us on the other side of the break. This is Will Grigg, Pro Libertate Radio, on the Liberty News Radio Network, and we'll be right back. We're back. We're talking with Art from the beautiful Copper State of Arizona about the problems associated with illegal immigration, or I would assume you'd be talking about problems associated with immigration in general, both legal and illegal, because I think your concern has to do primarily with the economy and with competition for jobs and depression of wages as a result of immigration to the country. Am I summarizing your concerns correctly, Art?
Yeah, there is, but I also have one final point. Regarding amnesty, is it really fair to give amnesty to these people who have broken our laws and are demanding amnesty? Is that fair to the people that are playing the game by the rules and waiting their turn in line to either become citizens or to gain legal status? I mean, that is totally unfair. And I think what Arizona is trying to do, it's often been said that we cannot deport, and it's really not 11 or 12 million, like they say. It's more like 30 or 40 million that are illegals that are here. What Arizona, I think, is trying to do is to make it so that we can't, obviously we can't deport that many people, but make it so hard that they'll just leave on their own. I think that's all that Arizona is trying to do, and I think that's what a lot of other states are trying to do. I mean, what's your take on amnesty?
I think there are about 11 other states that are considering some form of an SB 1070 type measure. Is that correct?
Yeah, not anymore. I doubt it. But, well, it depends on what the outcome of this is. But what's your take on amnesty? I'm curious.
The relative justice of amnesty would depend upon what one thinks of the system for naturalization or obtaining legal status, if that system is worth preserving. And I think that system is clearly not working as well. I'm still trying to decide what exactly should be done in the larger sense about immigration, because for the first century or so of our country, we didn't have an immigration law. There was a naturalization law. But naturalization and immigration are not necessarily the same thing. I mean, naturalization, of course, refers to citizenship, you know, participation in the polity, voting, that kind of thing.
And then the other thing, too, is a lot of these people that come over here have no interest in coming, unlike it was in the 1800s and 1900s, coming over here and assimilating into our society and into our culture. These people have no interest. And by the way, I'm an American of Hispanic origin, okay? My great-grandfather and my grandfather were both from Mexico. They immigrated here from Mexico. But these people don't want to assimilate into our society. I mean, they have no interest in being an American and acting like an American. They don't want any part of that.
Yeah, you bring up another really interesting part of this whole equation, Art, and that is what you could call the subsidized anti-assimilation lobby. And that's a big part of the story. Although I think perhaps its influence is somewhat overrated, it is a big part of the story in terms of the problems you're talking about. Mandatory state-funded subsidized bilingualism. You're talking about the cultivation of ethnic solidarity at the expense of acquiring an understanding of our civic culture at the university or even in the public schools. And these are all problems that have been cultivated since 1965, pretty much through the Ford Foundation. If you take a look at the group that's funding all of these anti-assimilationist or ethnic grievance lobbies, they all run through the Ford Foundation and its satellite foundations and such like. That's something else that has to be addressed here. Whatever we do with respect to the question of amnesty, with respect to the question of what Arizona's trying to do, which, by the way, resides, in my opinion, within their 10th Amendment reserved powers. I don't know why they're not making that argument. I think that, as Judge Napolitano put it recently, we've got a situation here where no president since Nixon or earlier, no administration has been serious about doing something about immigration because both major parties have a vested interest in keeping the problem alive. And I think
right,
that pending
and the Democrats look at it strictly as a source of more votes, you know.
Yeah.
that's all I wanted to
electoral warfare.
With you. And I'm
sorry.
Have a great night and God bless, okay?
God bless. Thank you so much for calling, Art. You live in a beautiful state. Take care. We go from Arizona to the People's Republic of Taxachusetts. Jeff from Chelsea, Massachusetts, is joining us this evening. Jeff, how are you doing?
Oh, I'm doing all right. Well, you know what's funny is America really is going down. And furthermore, I have some good quotes by Robert Mugabe because if you want to find...
favorite philosopher.
Oh, no, that's it. If you want to, if you want to find out the real roots of America's problem, just and really get your blood boiling, we will start off a nice warm-up from brainy quote by our wonderful dictator, Robert Mugabe, is right here. The only white man you can trust is a dead white man. Now, if you juxtapose that with the quote from La Raza, anything outside the race, total, outside the race, nothing. I mean, I'm not saying it right. I don't have the quote.
Por la raza todo, fuera de la raza nada. Yeah.
Yes. So simply put, there are good people in this country that want to stop this nonsense. One of my heroes is Jesse Lee Peterson, who wants to stop the reparations movement, who wants to stop illegal immigration, and who wants
Reverend Jesse. Yeah.
Yeah, my hero, and Reverend James David Manning, who tried to go for the throat of Obama, proverbially speaking, both of whom are black pastors, and you have people of Hispanic origin that want to stop this nonsense. But here's the sick part, and this is what makes my blood boil. You have people at the top that are propagandized that these people are sellouts and coconuts and so forth, coconuts for Hispanics, Oreo cookies.
Or Tio Taco.
Yeah.
I've been called a Tio Taco.
Tio Taco, whatever, basically these traitors. And you see, this country has to get over this stuff and stop hyphenating Americans and get back to securing the borders, having English as the primary language of this country, having a pro-life platform, having a pro-family platform, and getting back to the Bible, the Constitution, small government, you know, all the stuff that made America great, which the Republican Party believed in that at one time, but turned into the party of Rockefeller Republicans and neocons. You know, if this country doesn't straighten out, China will call back their loans, and they will pull the rug out.
Oh, they're already making noises about that.
Exactly.
Did you see what the head of China's credit rating agency, state-run credit rating agency, said about a week and a half ago about the nature of the public debt?
He said, I didn't.
Basically, the Moody's rating and all the other rating agencies that are used to calibrate the value of America's credit worthiness are being bent to political ends by Washington, and that really we should be looked on, the United States and the government of the United States particularly, as sitting on something less than an A rating in terms of our credit worthiness. And he pointed out that this vaunted military machine that the United States government operates has been bought and paid for by Chinese loans. And he's talking about this in the context of what kind of action they can take by way of bringing down this inflated credit rating that is the basis for government borrowing. And of course, that means that we're going to be hit with a huge uptick in the interest rates in order to placate the people who are actually funding what our government does. And the alternative, of course, to let the printing presses or their digital equivalents run amok and monetize the debt, which means we'll probably get both. We'll probably get huge increases in the interest rates and hyperinflationary expansion of the money supply, which means hyperinflationary price increases as well. So that's the sort of thing that I think that's going to happen sometime in the next couple of years. I don't think that that's going to be deferred until the next presidential election, personally. I think that before 2012, we're going to get hit with that double whammy.
Oh, yes. And to give a closing thought, and it's this. once we do collapse, and once the rug gets pulled out, you see, our enemies from Russia, China, and the Middle East, they will give an ultimatum if they haven't already, and they will say, look, we want a pound of flesh. That means we want your land. We want your American citizens as slaves in our countries. And we want full rights to dump your worst people on America. That means our worst criminals, we're entitled to dump them on your country, and you have to look the other way, or else we, as the world, is going to come in and crush you, because we have the numbers, we have the weapons, and if you ever heard of scalar weapons, which is more powerful than our harp, come in and just completely obliterate your country and make you politicians look like a bunch of fools. So what is it? And I believe our politicians have cried uncle and said, we're going to do as you tell us, and we'll have a nice golden parachute. That's the future, my friend, Zimbabwe. I thank you for having me on the broadcast, and do have a great week.
You too. Thanks for calling in, Jeff. That's one possible future that may be considered one likely future. I don't know whether the collapse of our unitary state right now would be the worst thing that could happen. I don't know what the geopolitical ramifications of that would be if we ended up with, say, several Americas, several American polities on the continental, the place occupied by the continental United States right now. But it would, of course, be attended with all kinds of tumult, probably no small amount of violence and hardship. That's another possible future as well. This is Will Grigg, Pro Libertate Radio on the Liberty News Radio Network. 866-986-6397 is our call number. We'll be back at you in just a minute. Robert Mugabe, the octogenarian despot who continues to afflict the country used to be known as Rhodesia, is somebody who was installed in that position, let us not forget, with the help of the U.S. State Department and Chatham House over in London. He's a tool, actually he had been a tool, but he was a beneficiary of intervention on the part of the Anglo-American elite. And if you want to take a look at the larger historical sweep and scope of that tragedy, you have to go back to the influence of the person for whom Rhodesia was named, and that's Cecil Rhodes. He was the guy who created the Anglo-American network that coalesced into this special friendship between Washington and London. And right now, of course, Washington is the senior partner, and they have like-minded allies and sycophants scattered throughout the world, not just the English-speaking world or the Anglosphere, as it's sometimes called, but throughout the world by way of such instrumentalities as the Trilateral Commission and such like. But Mr. Mugabe, as quoted by Jeff from Chelsea, Massachusetts in the previous segment, seems to have stumbled upon William Tecumseh Sherman's wisdom. It was William Sherman who, during the prosecution of the quasi-genocidal war against the Plains Indians, once said that the only good Indian he ever met was dead. Now you have Mugabe saying the same thing about white people. And of course, this is the type of crude reptilian brain collectivism that comes to the forefront when you're talking about taking from people something that you covet but cannot pay for or have no interest in paying for. Just a couple of hours ago when I was out foraging for dinner this evening, and by foraging I'm not talking about trying to extract berries and tubers from the barren and unyielding soil in the fashion of the anonymous father from Cormac McCarthy's The Road. It wasn't anything that grim. I was just going to a local Chinese takeout joint, and I found myself in a conversation with a young woman who was taking my order. She noticed that I'm reading a book called The Imperial Cruise, A Secret History of Empire and War, by James Bradley. I'll probably read a little bit of this at the beginning of the next hour, so if you're interested in hearing more about this book, by all means, tune in. But tune in by any means anyway. This is a book which was written by the same fellow who wrote Flags of Our Fathers and Flyboys. Mr. Bradley was looking into the history of his father, who was one of the people photographed raising Old Glory on Mount Suribachi in Iwo Jima. after he had written that book, Flags of Our Fathers, and become curious about the Pacific War, he wanted to look into the roots of that conflict. And what he found as he looked into the policy that was pioneered by Teddy Roosevelt, a man of many parts, Mr. Roosevelt, some of them commendable, some of them quite contemptible, Bradley came away with the impression that the Pacific War, the war between the United States and Britain and the Netherlands and a couple of other allies, Australia among them, and Imperial Japan, was in part the inevitable collision between the ascendant Japanese imperial power and the ascendant American imperial power. But in some ways, it was blowback from Teddy Roosevelt's empire building. One thing I had not known until I started to read this book was that Teddy Roosevelt, in the years just before he won the Nobel Peace Prize for his work in negotiating the Portsmouth Treaty between Russia, Imperial Russia, and Imperial Japan, had actually been involved in secretive diplomacy with the Imperial Japanese, in which he essentially turned over Korea to them. Talk to a Korean sometime about what it must have been like. No doubt, if this is a person born in Korea, he can share some interesting stories, to be under the benevolent reign of the Imperial Japanese. There were horrible things that were done to the Koreans in the early years of the 20th century. And there are some really strong and impassioned hostilities that still exist between Koreans and Japanese of a certain age, because Koreans have family memories of the things that were done when they were under the reign of the Japanese. But this is something that had been arranged by Teddy Roosevelt. His assumption, Mr. Roosevelt, and those of his kidney, those who surrounded him, was that Manifest Destiny didn't run out of room once the course of American conquest followed the sun to the limits of the continental United States. But it had to continue following the course of the sun across the Pacific. And that helps explain that splendid little war that occurred in 1898 under President McKinley. His duty, as he saw it, was to Christianize the Filipinos, most of whom were already Roman Catholic. They were Christian in the sense that most Americans, I think, would recognize them as being Christian. And unfortunately, in liberating, quote-unquote, the Filipinos from Spain, the American corporate trust that carried out that war liberated 250,000 of them from their bodies. They liberated their souls from their bodies by fighting a war of suppression that was declared over in 1902. For 4 years, the U.S. government fought a counter-insurrectionary war in the Philippines. That was the first time that had ever happened in terms of a struggle that took place overseas. Of course, there were counter-insurrectionary wars being fought against the supposedly pacified Plains Indians and Apache and Comanche. And many of the people who were involved in those glorious conflicts were involved in the conflicts in the Philippines as well. In any case, the point I'm making here is that anytime you get involved in imperial politics, when you're projecting power in the interest of conquering other people, you're acting on the basis of one of the two, and there are only two ways that you can acquire things in this world. You can acquire them through peaceful cooperation, through commerce, through mutually beneficial exchange, or you can acquire them through coercion. It is really that simple. You have to choose commerce or coercion. Many of the people who surrounded Roosevelt, like many of the people who surrounded Cecil Rhodes, many of the people who coalesced into Rhodes's Anglo-American elite, for public consumption would talk about a grand evangelizing mission to bring the entire world, particularly the teeming, swarthy masses of the East, under the scepter of Anglo-Saxon civilization. It was a form of missionary work. One senator actually had either the temerity or the hypocrisy, or perhaps both, to say during a floor debate, I believe in 1901, over the merits of Washington's suppression of Philippine independence, that our soldiers were not sent as conquerors, but as ministering angels. to confer the benedictions of Western civilization on that turbid and swarthy race. And of course, they were always willing to impute to themselves the highest and most refined of motives. And the side benefit, of course, is that we'll be opening up these areas for commerce. Don't you know that we're going to be opening up markets? Well, you don't have to open up markets with the bayonet. Sometimes you have to defend your property with a weapon, be it a bayonet, a blunderbuss, a pistol, an automatic weapon. But only when it's used for defense is it defensible. You don't pry open markets with bayonets. You offer, you solicit, you advertise. You do not kill and imprison and torture and suppress in the name of building a market. Now, the people who carried out that policy knew what they were doing was completely wrong and hypocritical, but they were, of course, intoxicated with a sense of power and possessed of a sense of historic mission. And in pursuing that mission, they were not at all afraid, as I have alluded in previous comments, to make an appeal to these atavistic notions of racial superiority, of melanin-based collectivism, if you will. So when Robert Mugabe is speaking that language, I think in some way he's mimicking the people who put him where he is. He's just transposing that gospel of genocide into a particular key. And you've got whites on the receiving end of his collectivist bigotry and his racially oriented genocidal policies. And they're wrong no matter who is on what side of that equation. Lenin, once again, defined all politics as a question of who does what to whom. Jesus of Nazareth said it's all a question of doing unto your neighbor as you would be done to. And it really is a conflict between those two visions. If we're not going to be governed according to the golden rule, we're going to be ruled by the iron fist. And that iron fist, of course, is what we're confronting here in this country. And it doesn't really matter how charming, how articulate, how folksy, or how appealing the person who wields that iron fist might be. We've reduced politics to an elemental level in this country that is taking us in the direction of Zimbabwe. And one of the ways that the people who are trying to arrange this are pursuing their malign designs is by getting us to think in terms of melanin content. We have to ascend above that. We have to transcend that type of politics if we're going to have any hope of preserving civilization. Thus ends hour one of Pro Libertate, the radio program on the Liberty News Radio Network. 866-986-6397 is our call-in number. We'll be back in just a couple of minutes, and I hope to hear from you.